Welcome to Our Hen House. This is Marianne Sullivan.
And this is Jasmine Singer.
And this week, Jasmine will be speaking with artist Jane O'Hara, whose exhibition, State of the Union, can currently be seen at the New Bedford Art Museum in Massachusetts. And it is really extraordinary and eye-catching.
Yeah, it's always exciting to catch up with an artist. I know that there are a lot of people listening to this who are particularly lit up by our artist episodes, and Jane is beyond talented. And also, we recently had our friend Gretchen and Gus, two different people, two friends, plural, visiting us. And Gretchen is Gretchen Primack, who wrote the book Kind, and has an updated version of it that she gave us a copy of. And Jane has some art in it, which was very,
really
cool. There's a lot of nice synergy there. And also, you know that new social media thing, Threads, that's like Twitter, but not Twitter?
Yes.
I joined that. And
I did too.
And, oh, you did? Okay. I'll have to follow you.
Now I find that both Twitter and Threads are annoying. Like, okay, there's some stuff on one, there's some stuff on the other. I can't ever find, like, the stuff I used to find, I don't find. Elon Musk
is
a useless piece of whatever.
Okay. So my first Threads thing, whatever it's called, thread. It was, I almost had tweeted, but I shared.
You threaded?
I threaded Gretchen's book because I was just reading it and I just love it. And then Jane actually responded and was like, what a perfect first post. And I'm like, oh, Jane, I love your art. And you're now on our Hen House.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't have the interview and all of these interactions, but I love this piece. I don't know whether it's a piece or a series of pieces. It's really, I love its retro feel. Mm-hmm. I just want to say, Jasmine, that I'm watching you on the screen and you're making me seasick. Oh. What are you doing?
Oh, because I'm at...
You're moving up and down. And I honestly feel a little nauseous watching you.
You want to go get some Dramamine? I'll wait.
No, I want you to stop.
Okay, I'll stop. I'm at WXXI right now. I'm in a recording studio and there's no seat in here. So I'm like not ergonomically correct, leaning on a counter and kind of moving around.
They don't have chairs at the radio station? That's so odd.
Not in this particular sound booth. But speaking of it, the reason I'm here is because I'm filling in this week for the talk show Connections, which I host when I'm among the guest hosts, when Evan, who's the regular host, is out. And I did a show today on cultivated meat, which was really exciting.
Yeah, I listened to it. It was great.
Yeah, thank you. You know what? We can put the link to it in the show notes because it does become a podcast afterwards. And I don't usually say this kind of thing, but honestly, if you're listening to this right now, you really should listen to this episode. It was fascinating.
And it's not just on cultivated meat. It was also on plant-based meat. It's on all the new meats.
Yeah.
Whether, like, I would assume that a lot of people listening, we're so used to being just embedded in this and knowing so much about it. I'm sure a lot of people listening, it's all news to them, especially the cultivated meat part. So it was really, really great that you were able to get that on.
Yeah. And I'm currently in the process of putting together, like when you have an episode of Connections, you pull out a news story from it and it runs later on All Things Considered. And I'm in the process of pulling out a news story on Dawn, who is a pig who resides at Sweet Farm Climate Sanctuary. And Nate, who is the person who runs Sweet Farm, is actually a guest on our Hen House coming up. We already did the interview, but he was one of the guests on Connections with me today. And Dawn, the pig, donated cells to become the cultivated meat that they're making over at Mission Barns, which is a California-based cultivated meat company. It's not one of the ones that the USDA approved for sale yet, but it's very close.
I could be wrong, and maybe they have a wider portfolio than this, but I know that one of the things they're working on is fat.
Right.
And, you know, a healthy type of fat, but that tastes like the fat that is in meat. And that could actually be used with plant-based meats. So, you know, to give people that flavor that they long for. But it would, I think it would be much healthier, you know, obviously immeasurably kinder than the meat that comes from an animal. And can I tell people my line that I thought of that they have to use for advertising that I'm so in love with, and you didn't even use it on the program, even though it was totally brilliant?
You could say it, but I want to first give a disclaimer that I think it's absolutely brilliant for cultivated meat companies to use. I just personally, even though I think it's brilliant, felt uncomfortable using it as an animal rights vegan. But go ahead.
I'm not even sure it's perfect for anybody to use it. It's just that when I thought of it, I loved it. Like Dawn proves that you can have your pig and eat her too.
It is very
smart. Oh my God, it's so good.
It is smart. I just, you know, like.
And you can have a little picture of the bacon and then a little picture of Dawn. I mean, in a way, it's like unbelievably gross, but it's also unbelievably cool. It's not quite as good as my, which I have not heard anybody else use. So I swear I invented it, though other people may have invented it too. My realization that if you are Christian and you're interested in that part of the Bible where the loaves and the fishes, where Jesus spread the multitudes with just, you know, like a couple of loaves of bread and three fishes, and everybody had a full meal, that was predicting cultivated meat, because that's exactly what you do. Those fish weren't alive. I mean, I've said this before on the podcast, so please forgive me. You've listened to me talk about this before, but it's so good. It's so good.
Oh my God. And there was also, you know, Winston Churchill has a quote from 1931, literally about cultivated meat. And I don't have the quote in front of me, but
I know. And it's crazy. Like he just completely predicted it, that we would make meat without the animals.
Yeah. So anyway, it was very exciting to do this episode. And as expected, I have to tell you, when I host the show, I get a lot of calls from callers. And I said to the person who was in the booth, I was like, listen, I expect we're going to get a lot of calls today, so just be prepared. And I hardly got any, but I got a ton of emails during the show. And I'm like,
that's so interesting.
I find it fascinating that people didn't want to call in. I really do.
Do you think it's because you're very intimidating?
I'm not you, Marianne. Let's be real.
Me, I'm not even remotely intimidating.
Everyone is intimidated by you. It's true. They are. You're intimidating. You have like that professor thing going.
No, that's ridiculous. That's just you. That's ridiculous. No.
Anyhow, one of the emails I got, it says, can I read it? I already read it to you, but I'm going to read it.
Yeah, but can I preface it by saying that, you know, this is not necessarily the way I would have approached it, but every single one of your guests characterized what was happening as creating choice. Like they actually said, this doesn't mean that people aren't going to still be eating meat from animals. Of course, some people will, but it's creating choice. All right. So now you can read your email.
Okay. Well, I got this email before the show, though, just so that you know, it came somehow. They heard the teaser to the show and they were like, this guy was like, I heard this teaser. Now I'm going to go email the. So he said, I won't be replacing meat with anything. I'll continue to go into the woods with a bolt action AR-10 and a 7.62 P mag, taking as many white tail and or black bears as I have tags for, field dressing them, processing them and eating them. The end.
Do people eat bears? I actually didn't know that. I don't doubt it, but people will eat anything in my experience. Yeah, like a little bit, just a tiny bit defensive.
Yeah,
just a tiny bit. And so it happened to be that there was this quote I saw on Twitter from George Monbiot, who I love. And it's just really, this was the perfect example of what he was talking about. I'm going to read you this quote. One of the surest signs of low political understanding is the inability to distinguish advocacy from coercion. I see it on Twitter every day. Someone says, this is the change I'd like to see, then spends the rest of the day being called a dictator. And this guy was like, he wasn't actually saying he was going to be forced to, eat cultivated meat instead of his dead animals. But that was the implication of this like defensiveness, that insisting that this is what I'm going to do, when nobody was implying that anybody was going to stop hunting animals or eating animals. I mean, I would love it. I'd be happy to go on and imply that people are going to stop eating animals. But nobody was doing that. That's not what anything was about. It was about creating choice for people who maybe don't want to eat animals. But yeah, that like there's, I mean, and this, it's not like it was just one comment. This is so typical, the defensiveness that you run into as soon as you mention that you don't eat animals, or that maybe like it should be possible to not eat animals. Where does it come from? Is it like some kind of, they want to think it's necessary because deep down inside them, they know it's creepy. I don't know.
I don't know either. By the way, just one quick thing. You know how like when we teach over at Main Street Vegan and we're going over questions that people will get as they advocate for animals, and we always say that one of the questions they'll get is what will happen to all the animals if we stop eating them? I sometimes am like, when we're doing that, I'm sometimes like, oh, do people really ask this? And that was the first caller we got today. Someone asked that.
Yeah. And it's totally sincere. Then this is how completely unaware people are, perfectly nice people who care about issues, who listen to like talk shows in the afternoon, like how unaware they are of the true state of animal agriculture and the implications of trying to change anything. They think that there'll be all of these animals left over. Like we're going to stop eating. Well, everybody will get together and stop eating them tomorrow. And then there'll be all these animals. What'll we do with them? I always say to my students when I bring this up, like, if that were to happen, if everybody were to stop eating them tomorrow, this would mean that, you know, the world had changed in such unbelievable ways that we would all, like in such wonderful ways, we would all get together and figure it out. But, you know, let's not like worry about that particular problem since chances are it's not going to happen. And also, I think it really implies that people are so unaware of what short lives these animals actually have. They think that, you know, even if people gradually stop eating animals, there'll still be all these ones left in the pipeline. Well, the pipeline is really short. I mean, chickens, for me, they're killed when they're 6 weeks old. It doesn't take long for that pipeline to get used up. I mean, I wish we had a way to save them all.
Yeah.
But until that happens, I don't think we have to figure out what we're going to do with them. But yeah, the real irony of the question, I mean, I'm giving you my answer, which everybody out there already knows, because the real irony of the question is, what are people thinking? Like, they don't know anything about how the world works.
Yeah, I know. It's like, I feel like I'm on another planet. I'm really struggling with the news headlines lately, but that's another story.
I think everybody listening to this was clearly born on the wrong planet. I think we know that. There's another planet somewhere that we belong on, and somehow we got sent to this one.
Agreed. I would like Jane O'Hara to be on the planet I wind up, because I don't know where I would be without art. So I think we should get to that interview.
I think that's an excellent idea. Jane O'Hara is a contemporary American artist and the curator and founder of Jane O'Hara Projects. Her work has been presented and exhibited throughout the U.S., and she is a recipient of a Culture and Animals Foundation grant, a Curatorial Opportunity Program grant for Beasts of Burden, and a rare AIR artist residency. She is also an honoree of the Courage of Conscience Award from the Peace Abbey, honoring individuals and organizations that have distinguished themselves through humanitarian causes, peace, and social justice activism. She will be joining Jasmine right after this.
If you like what you're listening to, and I hope you do, then please consider taking a minute out of your day today to leave us a friendly review. You can do it on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify or Stitcher or on Facebook or wherever you listen to podcasts or wherever you're listening to this. The more we get out there, the more our henhouse will be in front of people's eyeballs when they're putting in search terms in their podcasts, and the more we could join forces together to elevate the voices of the animals and change the world for them. So thank you so much in advance for leaving us a friendly review. Welcome to our henhouse, Jane.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
So happy to chat. I was just telling you, I love talking to artists. And it's funny because you're a visual artist and that can actually be challenging for an audio podcast. But I think that there's something extra magical about it, because at the end, after people listen to your story and your perspective a bit, maybe then they would go look at your work and it would give them a whole different vantage point. Do you find that doing like audio interviews is strange for a visual person?
Well, just as you said, I think it works that way. Hopefully people will be curious to look and actually see what I'm painting.
Totally, totally. So let's start with discussing State of the Union. Can you give us an overview of what people would see when they go to view this work?
What I've done is in the background of each painting, I have sort of the kitschy kind of appealing thing about that state, what that state would like to project about themselves, including the state animal, state flag, state flower, sights, some quirky, funny things about the state. And then in bubbles, I have approximately 5 bubbles for most paintings. I put things that go on with animals in that state behind the scenes in the either entertainment, food, science, business.
Yeah. Well, it's really unbelievably powerful. And you are doing a good job at explaining it, but I encourage people to go look at it. Where can people see it and when?
Right now at the New Bedford Art Museum in New Bedford, Massachusetts. I have 51 paintings, the 50 states, and then the title piece, which is USA, State of the Union. And it's going to be up at the museum until August 20th.
That's exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you.
By the way.
I mean, it's an exhibition that was put in the books 3 years ago at the museum. So it's been a long time coming.
Wow. Okay. I thought that writing books was the slowest industry because it's like 2 years from getting a book deal to the book being published.
Really?
But of course, that doesn't even count all of the work before it to try and get the book deal. But it sounds like you're in a similarly slow industry in a way. Although I guess it's not all about having art viewed by others, I guess art for art's sake, for the process of making it. Okay, that's a very strange question, but I'm actually curious your perspective on it. Do you feel like you are an artist for others or for yourself? Explain a little bit more about
what
that's
like. An interesting point you bring up because there are very different artists approach art very differently. And I do it for myself, but for me, my artwork is a form of communication. And so in that light, I do want others to see it. That is my goal. And my goal, which was met at this point with New Bedford Art Museum, is to get it out in front of an audience of regular old folks, people that are not vegan, that might be questioning some of their beliefs or some of
their worldview.
Yeah, worldview. Right.
Yeah, I actually can relate to that. As a writer, I will say that I really respect people who just write for themselves or like they need to do it and it's okay if it's never read. And maybe it's because we're activists.
Yeah.
And so we feel like what's the point of it being so insular? I'm not sure. But let's go back to State of the Union. What was your decision-making process regarding which images to pick for each state?
The first painting I did was Florida, State of the Union, Jane Velez Mitchell, Jane Unchained. I had been learning some things about Florida specifically that were going on, the red tide that had killed, had big fish die-offs and manatees were dying. And there was a Larson's Dairy where there was abuse within the dairy, which is already abusive. And then there was the dolphins and entertainment and primate breeding company where they breed primates for testing. And then there was a bear hunt there too, unnecessary bear hunt where something like 600 cubs were left parentless. So anyway, I had that information and I was just struck as I was in Florida, the contrast of that information with this sunny, fun, this was before DeSantis. Anyway, my awareness of him. But anyway, the sunny, fun vacation land view of Florida and then the contrast to what was going on behind the scenes or in plain sight in some cases without any awareness. So I just had this idea. I've used the bubble as a metaphor in other work that I've done. It's a way of kind of showing a separate yet unequal existence floating by in time, unaware of each other necessarily. And so I had this idea to do this painting and then also using the kind of kitschy postcard spelling of the word Florida, wish you were here type thing. And so as you probably gathered looking through my website, I enjoy the kind of contrast and I like luring people in with sort of playful images and then you can see darker things going on.
Yeah. Side note, Florida, what the heck? I mean, I remember growing up, my grandma was like a snowbird. And so I went down to West Palm Beach area every summer. And I just, it's like another planet now. I just don't, okay, that's not for this podcast, but I don't understand. No. So you sort of just did this, but can you pick another state as an example and tell us like what you included in more detail?
Well, California, in the background, I had the Minnie Mouse holding the state flag, and there was a lot of different things that I was learning that were going on there. There's the Santa Anita Raceway, where horses are mistreated and die, and UC Davis and the death with animal experimentation. I also featured these women that were protesting, and they're trying to save a downed calf. And they're arrested for grand larceny. And then, of course, the slaughterhouse, which is all painted up with these fanciful imagery. In the background, I have the state flag, which has the bear. And then in the background, I have the Hollywood sign. And I have the bear walking, which is the state animal. And
so the work is accompanied by a narration. So explain that a bit. What was your goal with it?
Because my work brings up, just from experience, as I rolled these out and show them to people over the years that I've been working on them, there'd be a lot of questions. And so I decided to have some text that would very briefly, kind of in a prose kind of a way, just spell that out, some of those things.
Some people are reached by audio, some people by visual, and some people by a mix. So I think that's powerful. I'm sure it's very powerful. There is factory farming everywhere, however, and for many of us, that overwhelms our thought processes, like of all the other harms that animals endure. How do you deal with the ubiquity of that particular form of abuse?
A lot of the paintings do have something about industrial farming, Vermont, where I have basically the story of dairy. There's a calf being taken away in the hut, and then it goes to the point of having the polluted waterways, the spray going over the fields of the manure, the toxic spray, and then the dumping of milk because of COVID. So that in that case, and in another case, I might just have a calf, just the head of the calf in its hut with its big tags hanging off of it. Mm-hmm. So I approached it differently.
Who is Nellie and what is her role?
So Nellie is my deceased cat. And I don't know, 7 or 8 paintings in, I just had this idea based on seeing some artwork somewhere. And I was like, oh, like it was actually a graphic novel. And I just had this idea of the cat, kind of Nellie, being a way to kind of be a link between all the paintings, maybe add a sense of humor, but also as a commentary of all of these different treatments and ways in which animals are in our world. And so as a companion animal, she's free to kind of cruise around and have a reaction or maybe just take a nap or not react at all. And I just also feel like on a deeper level, that's what every animal wants, that freedom to just live. And so there's the other extreme, which I didn't really get into with the companion animal, but how people pamper their pets or their animal companions to the point of really almost becoming surrogate family in the sense of dressing them up and extensions of their ego and whatever. It can get really extreme on that level as well. Mm-hmm. So all those things interest me.
Yeah. And also it adds a relatable element, I think, for people, because it's like having a companion animal in there is almost like an anchor for your average passerby who has never thought about cows before, but they have a cat who is their whole life. Yeah. So that's wonderful. And I would say it's a way to keep Nellie alive in a way, too. Yeah. It's really beautiful. So State of the Union is, it's just your latest work that involves animals. Can you tell us the story of how your art became so intertwined with your attitudes toward animals?
Well, animals entered my artwork quite a while ago. I hadn't been painting for a while. I majored in college for painting, but I then didn't do much for a lot of years. And so I started painting again with my now husband. And we went out painting plein air or whatever, painting landscapes. And I got really bored with that. So I started bringing pictures of animals in. And so the beginning of it was sort of a celebrating of their humor and the beauty of animals. But I had this pivotal moment where I was starting to learn some of the things that went on. I'd read Diet for a New America by John Robbins, and I didn't feel like I could become vegan, but I was sobbing reading it. And it was just, that's how it was for me. It was a slow information seeping in and not being able to get rid of it. Even though I really wasn't looking to be an activist, really wasn't looking to be a controversial or any of those things. So I went to this exhibition at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and it was the Byzantium exhibition, and had all these saints that had sacrificed their lives to powers greater than themselves, to God. And I just had this idea of animals sacrificing their lives to greater powers. In their case, it would be institutions and factory farms and universities, circuses. So I had the animals with the vestments, like what I was seeing in this exhibition. This idea just came to me, and I tried to push it away. I didn't want to do it because I didn't know what I was going to do with that, but it wouldn't stop nagging me. So for many months, I tried to not do it. And then finally, I'm like, I'm just going to do it. And during the process of doing it, I started to learn even more about what goes on. And so it was really a turning point where I started to integrate that information into my artwork.
The basis of our hen house when we started it like a billion years ago was basically like people should take what they're already interested in and what they're already doing and what they're already skillful at and incorporate animals. And I think sometimes it just happens that way, even if we don't choose to make it so. And as a fellow BFA person here, I can tell you that like being a creative who is working in the world of animal rights and in the arts, it's scary because, well, in your case, literally a blank canvas. I was going to use it metaphorically for me because my BFA was in acting, but it's like, oh, okay, well, this is how I changed the world, this canvas. And it can be overwhelming, but it's also such a beautiful way of expressing something that is so dark. And so I just want to say thank you for doing that because it is reaching people. I have this sort of theory, I'm curious what you think about this, that when people are taking in the arts or art of any kind, really, but we'll say visual since you're a visual artist, they have their defenses down more so than if they were being handed a brochure or if they came across a documentary, partly because when you take art in, there is a vulnerability that the artist brings, but there's also a vulnerability that the viewer brings. And there's some kind of magical connection in that connection between the viewer and the artist. What do you think about this? Am I being like weird and woo?
No, not at all. I totally agree. And I think that the thing about visual art is it's entered you before you know what's happened. That's almost subliminal. Whereas, as you put it, someone hands you a brochure, you can be like, oh, no, I can't do that. And people are catching on with my work that they might see something they don't want to see. I think that the arts are very powerful in that way.
Absolutely. And your work has been said to encompass an interplay of humor and irony. How did those elements combine with the tragedy that you are so often dealing with in your work?
Well, I want to have joy and laughter in my life. So having had some of my own dark history, dysfunctional family stuff, my response always was laughter and humor and dark humor. So I imagine it's born out of that. I just find the dark humor in things. And yet doing these paintings was very painful even before doing the paintings, just to learn and know what goes on. It's not that I don't feel it, but I do. I do think that humor, just like we were saying about visual arts, I think humor can be disarming and it can also be a way to lower people's resistance.
Definitely. Ah, yes. I'm very familiar with the dotted line from dysfunctional family to the arts to activism. And what is compassion arts?
Compassion arts is a group founded by Ellie Sarti, and it's a group that brings together all the different arts as the compassionate use of the arts to get the message for compassion for animals out. And so there's been a festival every year. Right now it's going through some restructuring, but there's been a festival and there's been other events. And Ellie found me, I think it was 7 years ago or so, and I was able to give a talk at the Worcester Art Museum showing slides of my work and talking about basically my story of how I became more compassionate to animals and used my artwork as a way to do that. So Compassion Arts has been a co-curated an exhibition called The Fifth Trust, which was based on the 10 Trusts by Mark Beckoff and Jane Goodall book. And so we did The Fifth Trust, and there were all the trusts were done by different forms of art and different artists. So it's kind of hard to put it all in a nutshell, but it's a very broad venue to explore these things with a lot of great ideas coming in the future as well.
I understand that Compassion Arts takes the concept of volunteer very seriously. Can you explain your ethos and practices around how it functions?
Yeah, it's volunteer run, and there is some restructuring going on, so things may change as it moves forward to become a nonprofit. It's not the end of things that I'm involved with, but people like you and me and all those artists that are passionate really seem to enjoy volunteering to get the message out in these different ways. And it's kind of a beautiful way to do it through the festival or other events.
What can artists whose work revolves around animals gain from being part of this collective?
Well, for me, it has been a way to have my work seen, to get it out there, to reach people that are vegan or vegan curious or just animal loving curious. And it is just like with my own work, Compassion Arts aims to reach people who are pregans.
Pregans, yeah.
You know, I think that the people who have been involved have had a very rich experience as far as giving talks at a veg fest or Zoom things since COVID. And I remember seeing you at the Culture and Animals and Compassion Arts Festival in the play. What was that play?
Oh, yeah. Sanctuary by John Younger.
Yeah, yeah. So I had given a presentation at that, and I also did a pop-up exhibition at East Suburban in the Upper East Side. And then I gave a presentation at the Symphony Space.
Yes, it's all coming back to me now. There was this like fuzzy thing in my head, and thank you for contextualizing it because it's like coming into focus. Tell us about the Beasts of Burden series and how they differ.
Okay, so Beasts of Burden, I curated. I got a curatorial award years back, and I curated Beasts of Burden, which at that point included, I think it was 13 artists. And not vegan, but just people who used animals as their muse in all different ways. And my ultimate goal was to show how animals are integrated into our lives in every way, whether it's psychologically or from everything from political stand-ins to humor, all these different ways. So I had these 13 great artists. And then I did the exhibition in New York, which was mostly the same artists, a few new ones. And I also got a grant from Culture and Animals Foundation to do a book. So I have a book that catalogs that particular Beasts of Burden exhibition, 2017.
That is so cool. How can people get the Beast of Burden book?
On my website, janeoharaprojects.org.
Amazing. I actually already sent your website to a friend of mine right before we hopped on here because are you based in Providence?
I am.
Yeah, so my friend like half lives in Providence.
Really?
And I was like, you have to check this out. It's so beautiful. So it really is. And just so that our listeners know, especially the listeners who are driving or on the treadmill, do not stop. Do not pull over. We're going to link to Jane's website in the show notes. Now, Jane, I won't ask you for favorites, but can you mention a few artists working now whose work might be of interest to our listeners and give us a little bit more detail about their work, why it resonates with you?
Well, I can say that Suko is an artist that, yes, you know, is really affected me very strongly when I saw a show of her work. I was not vegan yet. I was leaning that way. I'd probably already read the book I mentioned, and I honestly did not know that's what went on, even though I'd read the book. I just seen the visuals in the factory farm. So that's powerful. She obviously doesn't really use the humor aspect.
Right. Well, I think that, like, Sue, it's funny because she is very funny in this very witty, dry way.
I bet.
But yeah, I totally agree. I mean, her work is otherworldly. There is such an enormous chasm between the way we think we should treat animals and the way the world treats animals. How would you describe the ways in which the arts can bridge that chasm? And I know we talked about it a little bit before, but, you know, this is one of my favorite questions. And so I love just continuing to dissect it a bit. Much better than dissecting an animal, by the way, is dissecting questions about the arts. What do you think? Like, how can we better use the arts as a way to move the message?
Well, I mean, there's so many ways up the mountain, and that's what I love about the arts. Everybody's got a different approach. Suko has a very different approach than other people, but I just think that we all have our own journey. And for me, I mean, some people, the second they hear what goes on, they're like, I'm vegan, that's it. And it wasn't like that for me. I had a lot of denial. I had a lot of things that I just felt like I couldn't. And the arts have played a strong part for me as far as opening my eyes. And sometimes it comes in sideways, like that Metropolitan exhibition about the saints who had sacrificed their lives.
So I do want to chat with you a little bit more about your life. I'm going to save some of it for our bonus content. So if you're a Flock member, then definitely check that out. But would you mind telling me a little bit about, like, how your art takes up space in your day-to-day? What is your process?
I'm not a very scheduled type person.
Lucky
and
you.
And unfortunately, I work under pressure. So as the exhibition started to get closer and closer, I was in the studio round the clock, but I can go days without being in the studio. I sometimes paint outside. I sometimes integrate it into a vacation-y kind of a day. Other times I'm in my studio. So there is an art group in the town I used to live in, Little Compton, Rhode Island, that I go down to just for the camaraderie. And also I always paint there. I'm a quick painter, so I can get a lot of satisfaction just sort of dropping in these ways. The State of the Union series in particular took a lot of research. So that was a lot of what was involved with each painting. And so at some point, I just get inspired to just dig in with it. I started creating all these folders with information for each state. I had 50 state folders with all the different types of information. And then the actual just painting, I do get lost in time once I get into it, but I can be very guilty of procrastination when I'm not involved in something and the next thing's coming. It's just like I keep pushing it off until I don't know what that is, and I never will, but it's just part of the thing that goes on with me.
Is procrastination painful for you, or are you like, whatever, about it?
I'm a little more whatever about it at my age, just knowing that this is what happens with me, and I will get past it. And I spent about 25 years, along with my own artwork, but really predominant for many of those years, having a decorative painting business where I did murals and wall glazes and things like that. And I worked with interior designers, and that was obviously very structured and deadlines and all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I know, especially like working with the murals, that I could really see what happens with me. I get started the first day. I'm like, wow, I'm a genius. This is great. the second or third day, I think this is horrible. It's never going to be anything. And I just like, I saw some comic on Facebook about this, but I just know that these are the things, these are the swings that go through. And then before I know it, it's like, oh, I'm almost done. How did that happen?
That's so funny. I don't have the same process as that. However, when I'm in my version of the lull, like my version of the procrastination part, even though that is also part of my process, it freaks me out. It scares me. I don't know if I'm going to get through it each and every time, every single time. And I hate it. It's so uncomfortable. I'm like, maybe if it's like a block, like a writer's block, but I have to get something done for whatever reason. I'm like, I'm never going to get through this. It's over. Like, it's so dramatic. I'm so dramatic about it. So I appreciate your self-awareness.
Well, I think it's the artist condition. I just think that it's like the vulture has less of a pull than it used to, but it's the dynamics are still there. They still happen. Mm-hmm. Questioning, am I an artist? It doesn't matter what you have behind you. I realize that's just going to be something that comes up sometimes.
As we wind down, is there something that you haven't done that you really want to? And the sky's the limit here. Like, just curious. Can you just sort of put it out there? Because I'm curious about, like, your plans, like your bigger plans or your bigger dreams.
Well, one plan I have, which is very real, is to travel this show. And I want to find small museums or university galleries. It's not a commercial gallery type of a thing. And the book that I'm going to have made of the show, I'm having in the process, will help to that. And basically, that's the overarching goal I have, just trying to reach people. And I also, the very cold reality part of that dream is I would really love to be paid some money
to be able to do that. If you were paid some money too.
There's a gallery I'm a part of in Provincetown, William Scott Gallery, and I do sell paintings. But as far as this work, the State of the Union work, Beasts of Burden, I have some new artists, including Sue Coe and the next Beasts of Burden, when and if. And everything's been out of pocket for these things. I mean, the museum, New Bedford Art Museum, obviously it's their space they're paying for, but everything else has been out of pocket, any publicity, whatever. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it's not sustainable. I know at a certain point with artists, at a certain point, people start wanting you and the balance shifts and they'll pay at least for shipping or something like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So regarding like wanting to be at smaller museums, is there a way that our listeners can support you in those efforts? Perhaps they are connected to some kind of art outlet. I don't know why I'm saying art outlet. That's a very strange way of putting it. But like perhaps people can help you to get your work out there in their areas.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that I wouldn't. Very happy to have any help that anyone might have if they have a connection to a gallery they think might be interested. You know, you can reach me through my website. If you want to communicate with me, then that would be awesome. Yeah.
Yes, amazing. And we'll link to that in the show notes. Uh-huh. And Jane, thank you so much for putting all of this out there. We need you so much. And I definitely think that shift you were talking about is imminent.
Oh, thank you.
Because your work is really profound and powerful. And I'm so, so excited that you're on our henhouse because I know that our art loving listeners are going to be very excited if they're not already familiar with your work to become familiar with it. So
that's great.
Thank you so much. Thank you for joining us on our henhouse.
Thank you.
Social media has become such an important part of almost all of our lives. So please make our hen house part of that social media experience for you. You can like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter or Instagram. We try to post some news stories to help you keep up to date on what's happening in the world for animals. You can also find us online, of course, on our website, ourhenhouse.org, or you can email us. If you have some concerns or questions or something you'd like us to discuss on the podcast, let us know. info@ourhenhouse.org.
Anxiety's arising. Our first story involves a food futurologist. This is from a poultry future on the WattAgNet site four consumer trend predictions from a food futurologist. And this is the caption, Morgane Gay, a food futurologist. Apparently, we're just supposed to know what a food futurologist is. Well, I guess, you know, we could all guess. But apparently, I mean, it's just being, it's funny. It's being treated as a legit title. Anyway, her clients include Mars, Unilever, Nestle, Amazon, and more. So apparently, she's, you know, raking in the big bucks. Evaluates how economics, geopolitics, and even culture and traditions shape consumer behaviors and habits when it comes to food purchases. Even culture. Wow, that's amazing. Amazing how people make money. All right, so she points out that when we look at food, it's not in a vacuum. Well, unless, you know, it's in your thermos. I thought that was very funny. She explained, I'm a food futurologist, but I have to look at everything else as well. I don't know. So she's talking about consumer trends. First of all, the fact is that things are changing. This includes where consumers buy food, as well as a move toward more personalized diets based on someone's microbiome or DNA. I'll just leave that one alone. Who cares? And then this is the craziest one. Innovations in artificial proteins. And she acknowledges that artificial or alternative or whatever we're calling them, proteins are going to be important. But her favorite one are air proteins. Now, you may think that this is a joke, but I have heard of this before, and I thought maybe it was a spoof, but it's not, because she links to this site talking about this deal that Archer Daniels Midland has made with this air protein company. And like she said, that air proteins are created in fermentation tanks using CO2, nitrogen, and oxygen. So maybe this is what, you know, I've been heard referred to as fermentation meat. I've never heard of called air proteins, but she's kind of acting as if you make them out of air, which I guess is kind of true. We had Kartik Shaker on to talk about his book about fermented proteins. So she's all in on them. I think it is a little suspicious that she's all in on the one that's not on the market yet. But as she says, advocates say the resulting product is high in protein, vitamins, minerals, and nutrients with a lower environmental impact than traditional agriculture. Well, that's not hard to get lower than agriculture. So that's actually something I agree to keep an eye on. She's not keeping an eye on any of the other alternative proteins that are already on the market. Consumers are looking to reconnect. She mentions that in addition, younger consumers, namely Generation Z, I'm not sure she expects us to have heard of that title before, tend to place a high value on the environment. Unlike the rest of us, I don't care what the hell happens to it. I guess, you know, they're going to have to live in it longer, so they care. Good to know. Here's the real reason I included this article. Her fourth trend, kindness will be the new commodity. Kindness. I'm just going to read it. I've written several times about how the definition of sustainability is broadening. Once only associated with the environment, the term now also encompasses animal welfare, social issues, and more. These ideals all factor into the fact that kindness has become a commodity when it comes to consumers. Well, I would say the meat industry has a lot of work to do if they're going to include kindness. She goes on to say, once upon a time, we might have just thought that kindness was something we thought about in relation to other people. Kindness to everything and the whole chain of events now matters, whether that's to our planet, to our employees, to our colleagues, and to ourselves. Oops. Yeah. Animals got left out, didn't they? All right. Our next article. Oh, this is unbelievable. Got milk in school? Farmers fight health advocates over the creamy whole variety. And this is from the Minneapolis Post. So it's from, you know, a real newspaper. But in a big dairy state. America's milk producers, it says, worry about the type of milk schools serve amid a decades-long decline in milk sales. New competition from oat, soy, and almond milk is taking an increasing share of the beverage market from cow's milk. They're thinking here, actually, you have to think about it in a little complicated way. The competition is from oat, soy, and almond milk. So what they want to do, you know, but still, like, they're serving cow's milk in every school, and, you know, it's mandated. And so what are they all worried about? What they're worried about is that kids don't like it. And they think that the reason the kids don't like it is because it's 1% or skim milk. And, you know, 1% of skim milk is gross. And, you know, creamy milk, if you're a person who likes that sort of thing. I never liked milk, even though I like almost all creamy things. Probably is more delicious. And that's certainly the opinion of Amanda Kondo's son. She works at her family's Pennsylvania dairy farm, so he might not have a lot of choice in what his opinions are. But he doesn't like the flavor of the milk at school, and he won't drink it. That's because the cafeteria at his elementary school serves only skim and 1% milk, which he contends tastes too watered down, she said. It's a bad experience for kids who are our future milk drinkers, and it's leaving a bad taste in their mouths. So who are we really worried about here? Like, their future milk drinkers? Do we really want to, you know, preserve the industry? Is that the issue here? Well, that's not what they're pretending the issue is. We should blame Congress for the absence of creamy whole milk. And there are, she says, well, no, this article points out a growing number of studies that call into question long-held beliefs about the negative health effects of whole milk. When I first read that, I was like, yeah, I'm sure there are, and I'm sure they're all funded by the dairy industry. But later in the article points out that, you know, they're not all funded by the dairy industry. I don't know whether that's actually true. I would find it a little surprising. So what the dairy industry wants to do is stave also, in addition to getting back whole milk, they want to stave off a Department of Agriculture proposal to ban in middle and elementary schools the type of milk the kids like best. And I bet you can bet what the type of milk the kids like best is. It's chocolate milk, of course. And it doesn't matter whether it's low-fat or skim. Well, that's the only kind they can get, I guess. They like chocolate, so they're trying to get rid of that. No, like, kids aren't going to drink any milk if they can't, like, ruin it. Well, not ruin it, but, you know, improve it so it's not so disgusting. You know, it's so funny. They all talk about how milk is the perfect food, and yet they all want to change it all the time into something it's not. They're really upset about this. There's a bill in Congress, blah, blah, blah. The sponsor is Glenn G.T. Thompson. He's a Republican from Pennsylvania. He chairs the House Agriculture Committee. So he's a big deal. So he and the milk lobby are concerned, according to this article, about milk consumption in school, because if kids don't like the taste of lower fat milk offered in the cafeteria, they are less likely to ask their parents to buy milk or to buy it themselves when they become adults. That's the real problem they have here. Is anybody going to point out that it's not good for them, especially when they're adults? Instead of milk, they may drink soda and other high sugar drinks, Thompson said. Yeah, they might drink water. Or they might drink oat milk. Soda is not the only possible beverage that you can use as an alternative to milk. A growing number of studies, according to the article published in recent years, challenged the decades-long belief that whole milk contributes to childhood obesity. Much of that research was funded by the dairy industry. That's what I suspected. But, you know, according to this article, somebody not funded by the dairy industry says his studies and those by others prove whole milk is not as bad for health as once thought. And, you know, to tell you the truth, what they're doing here is they're comparing whole milk to skim milk or to low, you know, 1% milk. And the protein in milk is really bad for you. Like, there's all sorts of things about milk that's really bad for you. That's not what they should be comparing it to. They should be comparing it to water. Or even soda would probably come back better. So the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics favors the USDA keeping flavored fat-free and low-fat milk in all schools, saying eliminating these options would lead to a decline in milk. Yeah, if it weren't for dietitians, you know, we would know a lot more about what's good for you and what's not, because this is just horrifying. Like, these kids are being just forced to drink this disgusting crap. Meanwhile, back at on the farm in Mill Hall, Pennsylvania, this is the story we started off with the kid who wouldn't drink 1% milk. Kondo said her son wants the option to drink chocolate milk at school. Quote, I feel like she wants it to be whole milk and she wants it to be chocolate milk. Basically, why don't they just serve ice cream to the kids every day? Quote, I feel like milk is getting all the blame for childhood obesity while they are getting so much fat and sugar from other places. I feel parents should look at the amount of Mountain Dew their kids get. Okay, so, you know, the argument of the industry seems to be that milk is not as unhealthy as Mountain Dew, and that's about as much as they're willing to say, I guess. Oh, it's just, you know, we laugh, but it's just horrible. All these kids being fed this crap. All right. All right. Our final story is on a personal note, sort of a personal note. This is a story from Ireland, from a site called News Talk. Puck Fair changes criticized. The goat was looked after better than any king. All right. I know this needs a little explanation. All right. This is about something called the Puck Fair, which is apparently the oldest fair in Ireland, which would mean it's very old, like hundreds of years old. And traditionally, they've had a charming tradition where they take a goat, a mountain goat, apparently, put him in a cage, put the cage way up high, I guess on a kind of, you know, platform, but way up high, and leave him there for 3 days and nights. I mean, you know, they feed him and water him. I'm not saying they don't care for him. It's a very small cage. Well, isn't that why these people really know how to have a good time? And the reason this is a personal note, this is in County Kerry. And my grandmother was from County Kerry. And I looked it up. She was about an hour away from where the fair is held. The councillor, who is just incensed that there have been protests about this, his name is Johnny Healy Ray. And my grandmother's maiden name was Healy. So I feel like maybe I'm related to this guy. And I just want to thank my grandmother for leaving. I'm sure there's really, really wonderful things about living in Ireland. But this isn't one of them. All right. So this year, the goat will be raised for an hour on the opening night on August 10th and then return for a similar period of time on the closing day of the fair. So we're only going to torture the goat and terrify the goat for 2 hours in a small cage. And he's really, really annoyed. The majority of people that Johnny Healy Ray has met, quote, are very disappointed that there is a change to the format of the Puck Fair Festival. Like, who are the people that he's talking to exactly? Is it a fair cross-section of the residents of County Kerry? I don't know. I don't think anyone, he says, could question that the goat came down off the stand in better order than he went up there every year that this festival has been run. Because there were vets on hand and he was fed and watered. And he was looked after better than any king in any country. Wow. That's really good treatment for a goat, especially one who's like suspended up in the air. He criticized the groups who called for the change. Some of these people, God nor man, couldn't satisfy them if we tried. I'm so tempted to try to do an Irish accent here, but you can thank me for this. I'm not going to try because that would be a really bad thing to do. A lot of these people, whether we'll call them environmentalists or animal rights crowd or whatever they are, they do an awful lot of talking about animal rights. But if there was cattle or animals depending on them for the winter, I don't see them doing anything for that, only talking. Well, if they're animal rights activists, they probably don't own cattle. I mean, chances are. There was no word about the goats up in every mountain in Kerry all through the winter. What? I didn't see them carry them a bag of hay or a bag of rolled oats or doing anything for them. So apparently it's okay to suspend a goat in the air for 3 days if you don't take food to wild goats or somebody else's. I don't know. 'Tis only when it is a part of a tradition, or I'm not even doing the accent when the sentence starts with tis. 'Tis only when it is part of a tradition or part of a festival, you've a certain cohort, a minority, I might say, that like to undermine things like that. Well, if it's such a minority, they probably wouldn't be listening to them and they probably wouldn't be doing it. So, you know, Johnny, I think your time may have passed. I wonder if we are related. And that's it. On that weird note, that's it for this week's Rising Anxieties.
Well, that's it for our show. As always, if you enjoy the podcast and you're able, we would be thrilled to have you join the flock by going to ourhenhouse.org/donate and signing up for $10 a month or $100 a year. Or you are welcome to make any size donation that feels comfortable to you. You can also support us by leaving a glowing review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Like us on Facebook, where you can also leave a fabulous review, and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Our Hen House. Join our online community at ourhenhouse.mn.co and spread the word about the podcast to friends and family. The Mighty Networks platform, which again is at ourhenhouse.mn.co, is available to everyone, regardless of whether or not you're a Flock member, though we do have a lot of robust information behind the paywall of the Flock. section, so do consider that when you're considering joining the flock. And if you already support us, thank you so much. Remember, if you become a flock member, you also get bonus content each week, an opportunity to have a one-on-one session with me, Jasmine, and you also get access to that aforementioned fabulous flock bonus area of Mighty Networks. If you donate $250 or more, we'll also send you a pretty fantastic Our Hen House brass pin. So thank you so much to those of you who support us. Thank you to my co-host, Marianne Sullivan, to Vicky Beechler for her work in producing this podcast, to composer Michael Herron for the music. Thanks to Eric Montgomery of the Podcast Haven for his work editing the podcast, to our production assistant, Jocelyn Martinez, and to Veronica Kalinska, who designed our logo and other graphics. I'm Jasmine Singer, and I'll talk to you next week.